Okay. So, are you ready? You ready, PA? Okay. Okay. First of all, can you hear at the back? If you can hear at the back, could you put your hands up? If you can hear upstairs, can you stamp on the floor? Thank you. Great. I love doing that. One of these days, the floor's going to cave in. Great. So, today's talk is Harmony in a Divided World. I just thought of that just 5 minutes ago. The reason is that we want to create more harmony, not just in our world, but in our families, in our offices, in our monasteries, in our religious world, and everywhere. The more harmony we have, the more things we can do, and the more peaceful our world, and the more prosperous it will be. So harmony is just such an important thing. But why is it that sometimes that we are disharmonious? Mostly because of stupidity. Sometimes we think it's in our interest actually to create disharmony, but it's in nobody's interest at all. And once we see just what can be done when we all work together, it's amazing just the progress we can make. However, it is almost endemic in our society, in our modern society, because we emphasize competition above cooperation. And because there's so much competition encouraged in our youth, in our young people, middle-aged people, even in religions, because of so much competition, that's one of the great causes of disharmony. It's because I saw that many years ago, and because I was a school teacher before I became a monk. I don't know what the schools are like in Malaysia, but 1 year teaching in a high school, I think anyone would like to become a monk. But anyhow, just when I saw there that what was actually happening in the school, the children were learning from the very earliest years to compete against their friends in the examinations, because the person who got the top marks will go to the best schools, so they get the prizes. And sure, competition is important in our world. But as you all know, once you get out into the workforce, when you go out into your families, or even in your monasteries, cooperation is also incredibly important. And so years ago, I thought that in our education systems, perhaps we could change things a little bit to reward cooperation for children. I thought that maybe at the end of every school year, your individual marks in tests, assessments, maybe should cover maybe 60 or 70% of your total, and the other 30% would be shared over the whole class. So if the whole class did well, so did you. If the whole class did badly, so did you. So it was in your interest to learn, not just to compete and do your personal best, but also that you would look after the weaker members in the class. You would learn how to cooperate and work together. And in so doing, we'd have a balance between the two great forces of competition and cooperation. Because you all know that it's hard to learn how to cooperate unless we learn it early on in our lives. Maybe by the time we leave our schools, the competition is so ingrained in us that we take that into our married life as well. Where two people who are supposed to be as one are competing with each other, and that causes so much pain and disharmony, not just for the husband and wife, but also for the children, who see the bickering and the arguments and see their parents competing against each other, who's right and who's wrong. Unfortunately, that some of our monks are just as much to blame. Some of our religions are just as much to blame, competing against each other for who's got the right religion. So I've been working really hard in Australia over the last few years, especially recently, just before I came here, that's last week. In fact, a week ago today, I was in Sydney over 2 days, where we formed an Australian Sangha Association, which is comprising of all the monks and nuns of all the major Buddhist traditions, not just Theravada, but also the Vajrayana Tibetan monks, the nuns from Phokwangshan, the Korean monks and nuns, the Chinese monks, all the monks and nuns coming together for a common purpose. It was one of the most inspiring moments to actually to have that harmony between all the Buddhist monks and nuns in Australia. And I was one of the founders of that simply because I thought, look, if I'm going to go out and sit in front of people giving talks about harmony, isn't it much better to show that harmony and make it work? And it's not that hard to do. Because all one needs for harmony in our divided world is to see some commonality which we have. When you see that what we share together, what is in our interest, not my interest, but our interest, then harmony flows very easily from that. So just like, for example, in a marriage, two people living together, it's not in your interest to keep having arguments. You know what it's like when you've had an argument with your partner in life? Sometimes afterwards you think, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Sometimes you say you wish you did say that, but that's stupidity too. Sometimes you think, oh, isn't this... You go to bed afterwards feeling bad about yourself and feeling upset. The disharmony is not the way to live a life. It hurts you. So somehow we have to find ways of creating harmony in this world. And you know one of my favourite stories... No, I can't say it again. I always tell the chicken and the duck. You know the quack quack story? You know that one. If you don't know that one, I think I just heard that 200 books of Opening the Door of Your Heart is here today on sale. So you can look up the chicken and the duck story. That solves many marriage breakdowns. If ever you think you're going to have a divorce, chicken and duck, that will solve all of your problems in your marriage. The point being here that, just in brief, that story just shows us how stupid little things is what we mostly argue about. And sometimes, even in Buddhism, amongst the different traditions, sometimes the monks and the nuns can argue about the stupid little things, about which is the right way to meditate, or which is the best way to become enlightened. Look, you know what what's supposed to be the two main traditions of Buddhism, the Mahayana and the Hinayana, the big vehicle and little vehicle. And these days, as you all know, one of the reasons why the little vehicle is becoming so popular, because it gets through the traffic much more easily. And it's much easier to find a parking space as well. And I've seen this, these big vehicles, these big SUVs, which are not only bad for the environment, but you see they usually only carry one passenger anyway. So sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, what vehicle are you? Because look at me. Am I here for my own enlightenment? Am I just travelling all over the world, teaching, sacrificing myself? Sometimes it's the Venerable Kuang Sheng, he's the abbot of the Pokhak Si Komeng San Temple in Singapore. That's the one in Bright Hill Road, the biggest temple over in Singapore. He calls me the Theravada monk with the Mahayana mind. And you know, I was very moved about a year ago when I got an invitation for him to attend a ceremony at Komeng San Monastery, because he'd been acting abbot for many years and now he was being installed as the real abbot. And he had a big ceremony of installation as the abbot of the biggest monastery in Singapore. He invited me to come to give the keynote speech for him. I was sitting there in the front row with all these other Chinese monks, and they were all 80, 90, 100. There was one there, it's amazing, I love old monks. There's one there about 103, he walked up by himself to the podium, he didn't need any assistance at all. He gave this speech I couldn't understand a word of it, it's in Chinese, but he obviously had energy. Isn't it amazing to see these old monks still fit, able to walk and to speak? Amazing what the Dhamma does. It gives you a long life. It does. It's all this chanting which we do every day. Look, even our cat in our monastery is 18 years of age now, this cat, and it looks just like a little kitten. And why is that? Because every day it listens to the monks chanting. It's amazing just what Dhamma can do for you for old age. But anyway, I was just so moved to be able to give a speech and be invited at a Mahayana monk's installation as being an abbot. So we're great friends. So what is a Theravada monk doing hanging out with the Mahayana monks? And the point is that, look, I don't care what the tradition is, because I see the heart of it is all the same. It's the heart of all these things. I think the reason why there is disharmony in especially the religious world is because we stop at the books and we don't look at the meanings. I think this is our big problem. And I don't mean to be offensive at all, but recently, a couple of weeks ago, you've seen, I'm sure you've seen this in the newspapers here in Malaysia, there was a lot of upset, and quite rightly so, about stories that the US troops in Abu Ghraib have been desecrating the Holy Quran and flushing it down the toilet. That was the charge. And so somebody asked me, Ajahn Brahm, what would you do if they flushed, say, a copy of the Dhammapada down the toilet? And being Ajahn Brahm, I said, look, if somebody flushed the Dhammapada down the toilet, what I would do would be call a plumber. I'm a very practical monk. But I would never allow anybody to flush what the Dhammapada represented down the toilet. I would never allow them to flush peace, forgiveness, harmony down any toilet. And that's what I was talking a few moments ago. Even though you can blow up as many Buddha statues as you like, that's not blowing up peace, truth, virtue, goodness, compassion. You can never do that unless we allow it to happen. So this is in the different Buddhist traditions. It's recognizing these may be different vehicles, different messengers, but they are carrying this one and the same message. And that message is not found in the books. The books actually showing you the path, pointing out what is true. And they're all there for you to practice and see for yourselves. In the time of the Buddha, as you all know, with things like the Kalama Sutta, there's so many times when the Buddha said, look, find out for yourselves. Buddhas only show the way. You are the one who has to walk that way and find out the truth, each one for themselves. When we understand that, we understand the purpose of the Buddha statues, the purpose of the books, the purpose of all these teachings is as something which carries a message. But it's not the message itself. The message is the virtue, the goodness, the peace, the forgiveness. So once you find out what the absolute heart, the message is, in all the different, say, types of Buddhism, whether it's Zen Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, or whatever, or Theravada Buddhism, when you understand that what we're talking about is virtue, peace, wisdom, compassion, truth, forgiveness, how on earth can we have any disharmony? Because we're all pointing to the same things. And when I understand this, I understand that Theravada, or the so-called Hinayana, where it's just concern about your own enlightenment, I've never seen any monk or nun, layman or laywoman, following Theravada, who's just concerned about themselves. We all concern about others. And I've never seen any Mahayana monk or nun or lay practitioner who is not concerned about themselves and only concerned about others. So what actually is the right practice in Buddhism? Should one be sacrificing oneself for the sake of others? Should one be sacrificing others for the sake of oneself? Which one is right? Should you be looking at yourself or should you be looking at others? And the answer is both are wrong. Just looking at others, thinking of others, others' well-being. You've seen people like that. They get burnt out. Such people eventually not being looking after themselves. They don't have anything to give to others. Those people who just look after themselves and don't care about others, they've got no power, they've not got no strength in their mind. They become selfish and burnt and selfish and hard. There's no possibility of growth there either. But the real Buddhist way is the middle way, which is not looking at the other, not looking at yourself, but looking at what's between you. It's not in a marriage, it's not me, it's not him or her, it's us. And if you want harmony in a marriage, and you think about your partner, you'll never have success. If you think about just you and your needs, you'll never survive. The only way to go forward in the marriage is to think not me, not them, but what's between us, called us. Now you can understand, maybe, why the old idea of Mahayana, just sacrificing yourself for others, Hinayana, sacrificing others for yourself, they're both wrong. We're in this together, whether we like it or not. It's not me anymore. It's not you. It is us. So when we start to look at us, not him or her, not me, but us, then you understand why it is imperative that we learn how to cooperate in this world. Because we're in it together. We float or we sink together. So as such, sometimes people ask, well, Ajahn Brahm, then in the end, what are you? Are you a Theravada monk? Are you Hinayana? Are you Vajrayana? Are you Mahayana? And I've coined a new yana, which I belong to. And my yana is called the Hahayana. And if you've laughed, you're also a member of the Hahayana. Because religion should be not just too serious, but fun, and so should marriage. Because when we laugh at each other, when we laugh at life, then sometimes it's a great circuit breaker where we don't take on the anger, because in laughter it brings us together. We say something funny and we always laugh together. But we argue against each other. So sometimes in order to bring up that harmony in our world, we see what we have in between us. That's the commonality. And then we can see our common interests. When we can see our common interests, we can work towards that. We have to somehow, in our world, to see our common interests, value that, and work together for that. Competition is okay, but we need a lot of cooperation as well to survive. I'm sure that many of you in the corporate world will see that, because sometimes in an office, how much time is wasted in the politics of the office, in the backstabbing, in the trying to get an advance over you. But look, you should be Buddhist about the office, the politics in the office. If somebody gets a promotion and not you, you should be so happy. They have to do all the hard work now. You can take it easy. You ask Victor, any promotion means more hard work. I know, that being an abbot. I'm looking for a demotion, not a promotion. But it is true. It is true. No, some years ago, I thought of starting a Buddhist football team, a soccer team. But if it's going to go according to Buddhist principles of harmony and letting go, I'd realize we'd always be passing the ball to the opposition. And if they couldn't score the goal, we'd score it for them. Because it's all about compassion and letting go. And that's why we never started a Buddhist soccer team. But isn't it wonderful when you give the ball to somebody else in your married life? When you say, darling, I don't agree with you, but we'll do it your way. You know that in my early year life as a monk in Australia, I think the last time I had an argument was about 14 or 15 years ago now, with the monk who used to be my abbot. I've been the abbot there for about 11, 12 years now. But the previous monk, he was stubborn and I was stubborn. And we were building our main hall in this monastery. I'd already done a lot of building, so I actually knew about building. And so he had one design for this hall. I had another design for this hall. And we argued about which one we should build. I wouldn't move. He wouldn't move. And I was absolutely sure his idea was completely ridiculous and wrong, using a lot of money, not practical at all, not really what we wanted. About 3 days we had a standoff. Just like, you know, it looks like in a marriage, you know what it's like. And after 3 days I came to my senses. I realized, look, a monastery, it does not matter in a monastery what the buildings are. What's important in a monastery is the people, the monks. It can be just a monastery which has got gold everywhere, marble, which looks a work of art, which wins architectural awards. But if it's got monks or nuns in there which aren't living in harmony, what's the point? Is a monastery the buildings? Or is a monastery a spiritual place which is inspiring, not because of the bricks and the mortar, but because of the people who live there? That's what I thought. I said, look, I'm just destroying Buddhism by having this argument. It doesn't matter what the hall is. What's more important is we live in harmony and peace together. So I went up to that abbot and I bowed to him. I'd use a usual tray of candles, incense and flowers, ask forgiveness. And he was actually quite taken aback that I was asking forgiveness. He thought the argument was going to go on a bit longer. And after I asked forgiveness, he was moved enough. I said, can I ask a favour from you? And he thought, now he wants to do it his way. But that's not what I wanted to ask. I said, look, I want to do it your way. And can you please, my request is, can I be the builder? I want to build it your way. And I want to do it the best possible job I possibly can. So on the main hall in Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth, my name is on the building license. I built that, and I did it the very best I possibly could, simply because I thought it was wrong. And I still think it's wrong. But that's not the point. The point was I did it anyway, for the sake of harmony. And that was a great lesson in my own sort of religious growth. It didn't matter, you know, whether it was the best possible way of building a hall. It was the way it was built. That was what was inspiring. And to this day, I teach my monks that story about, look, if you're going to have an argument about which way it should be done, it's not important. What's important is we live in harmony and peace together. It doesn't matter about what the halls are like. It doesn't matter about where you go on a holiday. It doesn't matter what type of TV you buy. Just stop arguing. Isn't it more important that we have harmony and peace in our relationships, in our offices, in our worlds? And all this arguing. So sometimes people say, which is the best? The best part of Buddhism? Is it the Tibetan monks? Or is it the Zen monks? Is it the Chinese nuns? Is it the Burmese Vipassanas or the Ajahn Brahmajanas? Or which one is the best? So the best one is the one which doesn't criticize others. That's the best one. So we don't have all these labels about this tradition and that tradition. The ones who criticize others, there's something wrong there. Sometimes you might call it what we call spiritual materialism, the one-upmanship. And that one-upmanship, you can see it comes from ego, from pride. And it's that ego and pride of always thinking you have to be the best, you have to be superior, thinking that you have to... The only way you can win is by dominating others. We cannot win that way. The only way we can win the human race, in both senses of the word, is actually to learn how to cooperate and live at peace with each other. And when you actually start to learn to cooperate and live at peace with each other, sure, you don't get the best hall in the monastery, but you get the best monks. And you get the best tradition. It's a tradition where we're not really thinking about ourselves anymore. We're not even thinking about him. We're thinking about us, the relationship which we have with what we experience. And this is where that the harmony in a divided world starts to take off, not just to create more peace and happiness in our life and our outer life, but also more peace and happiness in our inner life. Because those of you who practice the inner life of meditation or contemplation, how many of you know what harmony means? Sometimes too often when people meditate, they fight against whatever they're experiencing. When they fight against their mind, it's not harmony anymore. And they find by trying to control their mind, they just get more and more frustrated and more tense. I don't know if I told this story here the last time I was here. Probably did, but who cares anyway, because I'm going to tell it again. But it was my 6th year as a monk. I found this wonderful monastery in north of Thailand. It was abandoned. I was the only monk there. I had perfect solitude. There was hardly any work to do in the monastery. And I was given delicious food once every day. The lay community didn't want to do anything except give me food. They never asked for any talks or any counseling or nothing. Not like you guys. Well, I don't mind. I'm a senior monk now. But in those days, that's absolutely like monk's heaven, this place. They just left alone all day to meditate, to sit and walk and just get fed. That's what they wanted to do to you, feed you. So the first couple of weeks in this idyllic monastery in the north of Thailand, up in the mountains, in solitude, it's a beautiful cave they used to go in during the day and just sit there for 5 or 6 hours at a time. It was great. But after a couple of months, my mind started getting restless. In fact, once it started getting restless, I couldn't stop it. It started getting worse and worse and worse. And after another week of this, I was going crazy. Basically, because the thoughts coming in my mind were what these days I call unmonkish thoughts. And you can work out for yourself what unmonkish thoughts means. But the harder I tried to stop them, the more they would come up. And it was getting so crazy that, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do. There was no other monk there, no senior monk or even junior monk to talk to. So out of desperation one day, I remember I went to the main hall, bowed to the Buddha statue and asked for help. And the inspiration which came to me, maybe it's because I was a Westerner, was to do a deal. Business monk, do a deal. And the deal was this. I said, mind, if you wanted to think about unmonkish things, you know, girls, romance, that sort of stuff, I said, look, you can do it for 1 hour of the day between 3 and 4. And get it out of the way. And the rest of the day, you behave. So, you know, just like your kids, you know, want to sort of watch video games. Okay, 1 hour you can watch your video games. The rest of the day, you've got to do your homework. I thought that was fair enough. That's reasonable. So I told my mind, okay, well, you watch your breath most of the day, 3 to 4, anything goes. So this is what I did, and I tried that. But it wasn't easy at all. In fact, it was just as hard. Still, I'd try and watch my breath, and all these thoughts would come up, saying, no, you're a monk, stop thinking that. You watch one or two breaths, and these thoughts would come in again. It was a struggle. But when it came to 3 p.m., it was a time to keep the other end of the bargain. I went up to my room, leant against the back of the wall, put my feet out and said, right, whatever you want to think, you know, sex, women, romance, anything goes. And for the next 1 hour, my mind was so peaceful, just watching the breath without any problem whatsoever. And that was incredible, actually, to see just how easy it was to watch the breath. And why, when I was struggling, I wouldn't do it. But when I let go, it was so easy. And I realized then about what harmony is and how you put harmony in the mind. The reason why my mind was very restless, because I was creating disharmony inside of my mind. In your mind, you may look at your life as the observer and the observed. This, as it were, is a watcher, an observer, a knower. And what you're experiencing, and what do you put in between that? Sometimes we want to control what we're experiencing, the object of our mind. We don't put peace, compassion between us and the object of our mind. We put hatred, ill will, sometimes craving and desire in there. In this particular case, I was putting ill will between me and those thoughts which were coming up. That was actually what was feeding them. I now know what harmony means. It means making peace. It doesn't matter what's happening, you just make peace with it. And then I started understanding some of my teachers, Ajahn Chah's great Dhamma. Because it was a time in my first year as a monk when we were meditating really well, and then the villagers, these local villagers over 30 years ago, would have parties in their village. They just discovered generators and amplifiers. And they would use them to the max. And because, you know, all the head people in the village, the head in the village was there, they would turn these amplifiers up so loud that in your hut, in your monastery, it was like having them next to you. And it was so loud. And they kept this party going till usually about, you know, 2:30 in the morning. And you get up at 3 o'clock, you know, to go to the morning meeting. You wouldn't have any sleep at all. So when you got up, that's when they started going to bed. It was really unfair. So we complained to our villagers and said, look, you know, you're supposed to be supporting us monks. You're supposed to be Buddhists. At least, you know, turn it down at 12 o'clock so we can do a little bit of sleep. We can't even meditate. It's really unfair. But they wouldn't listen to us. No way would they listen to the Western monks. So we thought, let's complain to the teacher, Ajahn Chah, because he was famous. He had authority. Maybe he would be able to tell those villagers to keep it quiet. So when we complained to him about the noise and how it was disturbing us, that was the occasion that he came back and said to us, monks, it's not the noise disturbing you. You are disturbing the noise. Now, of course, these teachings from great monks like that are very powerful. And it was not just this one-off about noise from a party disturbing you. It's also, you can actually say this, say to you, for your wives, for your husbands, it's not your husband disturbing you. You disturb your husband. It's not your wife disturbs you or your husbands. You are disturbing your wife. It's not life disturbing you. You are disturbing life. It's a great teaching that is about how to live in harmony with life. Because we want to make it perfect before we can live in harmony with it. Just like I wanted to make my mind peaceful before I could let it go. And I realized no way you can do that. You have to let it go, even though it's thinking about all sorts of different things, and then you get peace. The only way you're going to have a harmonious relationship is not to try and change your wife, not to try and change your husband. You have to learn harmony now. And you'll find, if you put harmony between your in your relationship, between this person and the other person, it becomes us, then the whole ball game changes. Where once you thought there was no hope of living together in peace, now you can live in peace with anybody. It's not that hard. Stop disturbing them, and they will stop disturbing you. So this is actually a beautiful way of actually doing something about the causes of disharmony in the world. Too often we think it's his problem. Or if we don't think of it's his problem or her problem, we think it's my problem. This is why that in modern psychology, people go to therapists because they want to get themselves fixed up. And why it never works, no matter how much you try and fix yourself up, you're looking at the wrong place. Other times you want to get your friends and fix him up. And then it doesn't work again. It's an us problem. It's our relationship with the world. It's our relationship with other people. How many of you ladies are still looking for a partner in life? How many of you men still want to have a partner? And sometimes you keep looking. Sometimes you find one, it doesn't work, so you just try and find another one. What's going wrong? So look actually just the way you relate to others. What you put in that relationship in the middle. And if you know that, you know what the middle way is all about. Looking in the middle. And then we can actually look just what's in the middle between our relationships with the people in our workplace. Any leader of a corporation knows it has to be a team effort, a group effort. Competition is great sometimes, because we have to work harder to sort of better our sales or better our performance. Just like it's great having competition, having a Tibetan monastery next to a Theravada monastery, which is next to a Zen nunnery. It's great to have competition. You know, because what that does, it means that better my game to keep up. And so does everybody else. We learn from each other. But it's also true that we should learn how to cooperate as well. In that cooperation, it's the us bit where we can say, look, it's important for each one of us to work together for a better world, for an understanding world, for realizing that in all these books is something which we share in common. Which is one of the reasons why I love this Mahayana concept of Buddha nature. Because too often that people actually come and ask me this same question, and that question is, how can I forgive him? How can I forgive that lady for what she did to me? How can I forgive even myself? And for any of you who have ever found it hard to forgive, this is the reason why. It's because you haven't taken that very first step. The very first step into the freedom of forgiveness is to see something in that enemy which is worthy of forgiveness. Seeing something there, even only a small thing. Because once you see that small thing, some redeeming feature in your so-called enemy, then there's a possibility of forgiveness. Any time you have an enemy, isn't it the case you can see nothing good in them at all? That's the only reason why you can discard them. Isn't that the case when you have that enemy inside yourself called guilt? When you feel just such a lack of self-esteem that people actually commit suicide. Why do they do that? Because they can see no redeeming features inside themselves. So these days, when anybody has an enemy, or is depressed, or is feeling very guilty, you have to somehow to see something good in that object of anger, some redeeming quality. And this Buddha nature business is actually where, you know, we have the Buddha's teaching of in every being there is a Buddha nature, there is something beautiful and wonderful there. So if you're having a big argument with your partner in life, or with your children, or with your parents, how about stopping looking at the causes of that argument and starting looking for the beauty, the Buddha nature, in the person you're arguing with? If you're about to get divorced, how about looking for the Buddha nature in your ex? You can start looking at the Buddha nature in that person. Sometimes it becomes possible to start again. And the relationship doesn't need to fall apart. You can see something in there which is worthy. Something which can inspire you. A seed. A spark to start the fire, you know, of your relationship again. This happened to me when I was young. Sometimes some people, they mistreated me, they abused me, and I got angry at them. They were my enemy. And it really surprised me that other people liked those guys. I said, how can you like a person like that? Look at what they did to me. And they said, oh no, no, they're very nice to me. They're so kind to me. It became as quite a shock to see that my enemies had people who loved them. Now your enemies in life, no matter who they are, do you ever notice there's people who think they're wonderful people? They have children, they have parents, they may have a lover who thinks they're incredibly good people. They're seeing something which you can't see. So, in order to overcome that disharmony of anger which creates enemies, a great thing to do, if you cannot actually see yet their Buddha nature, is to put yourself in the shoes of a person who loves them and cares for them. Put yourselves in the shoes of that person's mother. Look at that enemy through her eyes. And then it becomes very easy to see the Buddha nature in that person. I've been doing that for so long now. I can't see anybody in this world I don't respect. Even the times when I've been in prisons, you know, visiting some monsters sometimes, you know, people who've, you know, done serial rapes and murderers, have done terrible crimes. When you meet such people, you can still see something inside of those beings which is worthy of respect, which is a source of beauty and inspiration. I can see their Buddha nature, if you like. When I can see that, a strange thing happens. When I notice it, they start noticing it as well. Have you ever experienced that, what people see in you? Sometimes you can start seeing in yourself. Things which you never noticed were there, they see in you. Wow, yeah, that's true. That's in me as well. And because they started seeing their good nature, that's why they started to get better. And because they started to get better, some of those people, when they were released from jail, they never committed those crimes again. They were rehabilitated. That was one of my great strategies for rehabilitating these prisoners, to get them to see something good inside of themselves, so there can be some harmony in their inner world. One of the stories, a very moving story about that, was when I was visiting a couple of drug dealers in a jail. And when I was visiting them, teaching them some meditation, trying to get their lives back on track again. But on this one particular occasion, I think I got there earlier than the class. And one of the guys, his name was Nick, he was in jail for many years for dealing drugs. He took me by the arm and dragged me off to the schoolroom. I didn't know what he was up to. But when we got into the schoolroom, he showed me on this board all these little greeting cards. And I started reading them. Dear Nick, I hope you get out soon. Thanks for visiting our school. Signed, Genevieve. And he told me the story as he started crying. A few weeks before, a local school had decided to do a program on drugs to try and help their children not get involved in the drug scene, which is rampant in Western countries. I don't know what it's like in Malaysia. But they asked the education department for an expert. The education department suggested this professor who got a PhD in drugs. And to give credit to the principal of this school, she said, no, that would be just so boring, it will not connect with the kids. She had the ingenious idea of inviting two people who really knew what it was like to get involved in that stuff, and who had paid the price, both physically and also emotionally. She managed to get two prisoners from the local jail to go to that school, spend a day with children being involved in drugs. They spoke from their heart from the bitter experience of losing everything, their money, their respect, their jobs, quite often their family as well. They were put inside for many years for dealing drugs. When they showed me those cards, because after the next day, the children were so impressed, they wrote all these cards to their two friends. Dear Nick, I'll never do drugs. Honest, signed Stephen. Dear Nick, please come back again. It's terrible what happened to you. I will never take any marijuana. Signed Julian. Card after card after card was on that wall. Little kids speaking from their heart, saying how much that visit had meant to them and how they would never touch drugs at all. And Nick started weeping. He cried his eyes out. You couldn't stop him. Because he'd done something. He had made a huge mistake. But now he was paying off his debt by doing something good. Because he was doing something good to stop kids following the same path, he started to see something good inside himself. He saw in those cards written by kids his Buddha nature, his beauty, his kind compassion. And when he saw that, that was the start of his rehabilitation. I saw him many years later when I was in Perth Airport just waiting for somebody. And he put his I felt a hand on my shoulder. And I turned round, it was Nick in a very good suit. He'd obviously been doing very well with his life. And you know what his first words were? He said, "Brahm, I'm still meditating, I'm still meditating." This is so sweet. That strategy had got himself back in harmony with his life, at peace with his life, because he saw something good inside of himself. And this is so important, actually, to get harmony in our world. Get harmony in ourselves by putting goodness, seeing something beautiful in there. Putting harmony in our world by seeing beauty between us and our boss at work. Seeing something beautiful and kind and wonderful there. Because once we can do that, if you can see something beautiful in your partner, and remember that, keep focusing on that, don't keep focusing on their faults, then you have a relationship. And that relationship of harmony is so important. Look at the harmony which I have with you, which you have with me. You put something beautiful between us today. It's not me, it's not you. It's the Dhamma which is between us, which I've been talking about. And when you put that beauty, that Dhamma, that truth, that virtue there, that is a vehicle. That is a message which is... You can never flush that down the toilet. You can never blow that up. That is what Buddhism is. That is what Dhamma is. That is what truth is. So whenever you get upset, if you just get upset at yourself, or you get upset at that person over there because something has happened, you're missing the point. You're sacrificing. The important thing is your relationship with them. We are in this together. I can't live without you. This is why the Buddha set it up for monks and nuns to be completely dependent upon the lay community. If you don't like this talk, you won't feed me tomorrow, and I'll be hungry. That's why I put a lot of effort into my talks. And if I don't teach you, you'll be moving away from goodness. See, we depend upon each other. It's almost like a marriage. And all life is a marriage. You get married to your boss at work. You have to work together. Your work colleagues, the people who drive to work, you're in these lanes together. You have to work in harmony. If you don't work in harmony together, if you're always competing, who's going to get there first? You just get this terrible road rage business. Do you have road rage in Malaysia? You do. That's crazy. There's this example I read in New York. These two people, I don't know why people always follow what happens in the United States. It's a fashion. If they do it over there, then you have to do it in Malaysia. But there's these two people had road rage. I don't know what happened, but they're really angry. They're honking their horns. They were clenching their fists at each other, racing each other. They got to this red stoplight, and one of the guys was so angry, jumped out of his car, you know, because both cars were stopped next to each other, started banging on his enemy's car, banging and banging, trying to get in. And fortunately, the red light changed, and so the car he was banging on sped off, and he went to get in his car to chase him again. It wasn't there. When he got out of his car and went banging on the other car, one of these street kids had seen he'd left his keys in the engine. The engine was still running. He just got in this guy's car and sped away too. So he was left in the intersection with no car. Serves him right. That's what happens when you're angry. You miss the point. Do you get angry still? What do you get angry for? When was the last time I told the story about the man who went to the market for the eggs? You know that story? Yeah. No, okay, now I'm going to tell this because this is a nice one to finish off. It's such a powerful story. There was a guy, had the afternoon off work. His wife was cooking the dinner. His wife said, "I need some eggs. I haven't got time to get them myself. Can you go to the market and get some eggs for me?" And he said, "Sure, darling, no trouble at all. But I've never been to the market before. Please give me instructions." So she gave him a basket, some money, and told him exactly where to go, where the egg store was, how many eggs to get, what type of eggs, etc. So when he got into the market, this young man came up to him and called him Camel Face. "So you smell like dog poo." He said, "What? I don't even know you. Don't be so rude." But that just encouraged the man. And this young man started hurling abuse, more crude, more obscene, and in a louder voice, in front of everybody. Have you ever been cursed like that? If it's in front of everybody like that, you get so humiliated. And this man said, "Look, I don't even know you. I haven't done anything. Why are you getting so angry at me for?" But the young man wouldn't stop. So the husband just got so embarrassed. He got so upset. He turned around and went home. And when he got back, his wife said, "Darling, you're back early." "Yeah, and I never want to go to that stupid market ever again." When he calmed down, his wife said, "What happened?" "Oh, those people, they call you all sorts of names. I've never done anything. And they scolded me, they cursed me, they abused me." "Who did it?" said the wife. "Oh, this young man. What did he look like?" And when the husband described this young man, the wife said, "Oh, it's him." The poor young man, when he was young, he had an accident. He got a hit on the head. His brain damaged. The poor young man can never go to school. He will never get a job. He will never have a family. He's crazy because he hit his head when he was young. He does that to all of us. He does that to me sometimes. Whoever goes into the market, he abuses and curses because he's crazy. But we don't mind. We know he's crazy. He hit his head. As soon as the husband realized the abuse was coming from a crazy man, it didn't matter so much anymore. It doesn't matter if it's a crazy man. They call you, you know, dog poo or camel face. He's crazy. What's the matter? Soon as the wife realized the husband had understood, she said, "Look, darling, I really still need those eggs. Can you go back to that market? Don't mind that crazy boy." And he said, "Ah, okay, sure." So he went back to the market. The young man came up to him again and said, "Hey, here comes dog poo. Here comes old camel face." But this time it didn't matter because he knew he was crazy. He went right to the egg store, bought the eggs. The young man abused him all the way to the egg store, all the way out of the market. He didn't matter. He didn't mind at all. Because the guy was crazy. Now, when the Buddha told that story, he said, if someone scolds and abuses you, say your husband. Just imagine that he must have hit his head that day. And it's temporary insanity. Because all anger... all anger and scolding is temporary insanity. No one in their right mind scolds others, especially the people they love. So when you're having abuse from somebody else, you're being scolded. Always remember that. That guy, that woman, she must be crazy. My wife, I don't know what's happened to her, you know, because it's very hard to understand women's things. They must have hit their head today. They're crazy today. So if they scold you, you don't need to get upset back. Now this is, that's the one the way we can get harmony in the world. If people do stupid things, like flush a holy book down the toilet, I think those guys must be crazy to do that. They're out of their mind. They must have hit their head. So because of that, I can forgive them. Wise, sane people don't do such things. So that's actually how we can deal with abuse in this world. Somebody blows up a Buddha statue in Bamiyan. They're crazy guys. Poor things. I'm not going to get upset at them. So if you can do that in that level, can't we do that in other ways in our life to create peace and harmony? So these are strategies. When you actually see the Buddha nature in other people and their harm, their anger, their scolding, their craziness, and we don't need to take it personally, and we can actually make this connection, this relationship which we have with all beings into metta. When we say, may all beings be happy and well, what, may I be happy and well, what we really mean is we're putting loving kindness, this peace, between us and all other beings. It's the relationship we have with them. That is what's important. So when we understand that harmony is a relationship, we understand that, like an idea of sacrificing yourself for others or sacrificing others for yourself are both wrong. It's what's between us. That's the Buddha way. And if you put harmony between you and the other, not thinking of me, not thinking of them, but always thinking of us, not just thinking of the Buddhists, not just thinking of the Muslims, not just thinking of the Christians, but us, not just thinking of human beings, but the animals, the insects, invisible beings, we start thinking of us, not me. How can there ever be any exploitation? We're in this together. It is an us. And so we understand that. We understand where harmony comes from. And if we keep focusing on that, not only will we have harmony in our world, but also have harmony in our meditation. If it's your breath and the watcher, it's us. It's not watching the breath which is the problem. It's how you're watching it. Even if you're tired. There's nothing wrong with being tired in your meditation. Don't fight it. Don't make a war with your sloth and torpor. Put metta to whatever you're experiencing. And then you're in harmony with yourself. If you're sick, don't ever put ill will between you and that sickness. Put harmony and peace there. It's not what you experience in life. It's how you're experiencing it. It's not the noise which disturbs you. It's not the sickness which disturbs you. You are disturbing your sickness. If you understand the meaning of that, you understand harmony, peace, and the way to enlightenment. So there, harmony in a divided world. Divided against yourself, divided against your nature of having a human body which is now sick, now healthy, now old, now young. Divided against other members of your family, divided against other parts of Buddhism, divided against other religions, divided against other beings, other species. This is a way for harmony with a capital H. Putting peace, loving kindness, truth, freedom. In the middle. It's us, not me, not you, us. So, there's a talk today, harmony in a divided world. So now is the most interesting time, the time for questions, comments and complaints. So, we've also got the microphone upstairs, I hope. Is there? Yes? And so I told the people upstairs that because they are today in the higher realms, down here we're in the lower realms, your karma is not so good. We expect some much more interesting questions from up there in the higher realms. So you have to ask some tough questions up there. Who's going to ask the first question? I don't have to tell you this story again, do I? Every time about the course of being intelligent in your next life. The Buddha said the karmic cause of being stupid in your next life and the karmic cause of being intelligent in your next life. If you want to be intelligent in your next life, this is straight from the Buddha sutras. If you don't ask questions in this one, you'll be stupid in your next life, said the Buddha. Doesn't matter how hard you work on your homework, it won't work because you didn't ask questions. On harmony, yes, we got the question, yes. Yeah. Yeah, the Middle East and the disharmony there, and what's going on over there. It'd be wonderful if all the Israelis could study Islam, and all the Palestinians could study Judaism, and if they could both study those and just live with each other and realize that. Sometimes that because we separate ourselves out into this group and that group, and we live with each other, we marry each other, just within our own groupings, and sometimes what happens is there's a lot of misunderstanding between the other. I was very fortunate as a young man because my parents were quite poor, mostly because my father was very sick for most of his life. So the school I went to in West London was a very poor school with lots of immigrants. So because there were people from Africa, from the Caribbean, from Eastern Europe, all sorts of people were at my school when I was growing up. But I didn't care. If anyone could play good soccer, they were in my team. It didn't matter what colour they were, what sort of race they were. And so I say that my early upbringing caused me to be colourblind. And actually living with other races, with other religions, causes a huge amount of tolerance and respect. And I think that that's something which we need to do. Yeah.
I think, Rob, since there is so much hatred, distrust and harmony in the Middle East, why doesn't a body like the World Buddhist Council at least take some initiative, speak to the political leaders of each country and preach them the gospel of harmony? And why is it that I can relate to whatever you have said, but I think with due respect, the World Buddhist Council needs to walk out of that box and make an attempt along the way. Maybe pause, but fall forward, get up, move forward again. Why are no attempts being made, or unless attempts are being made and I'm not aware?
What do you think I've been doing today? But we're doing that, we're getting there. Little but.
Are there attempts by the World Buddhist Council?
There is no World Buddhist Council. We are. We are the World Buddhist Council. We're not all Buddhists in this room. I'm sure there's many Christians, atheists, agnostics, Hindus in this room. We are doing it. But it doesn't come from up the top, from World Buddhist Councils or World Christian Councils or whatever. It has to come from the ordinary people. Grassroots, yeah. We get from those grassroots, make friends with a Muslim, make friends with a Hindu, make friends. And if your children say, I don't know what religion you are, say you're sort of a Hindu and your children want to marry a Christian, say, wonderful. Good on you, and I'll support you. Because when we actually do this, I think that's where we're making huge steps in actually breaking down the barriers of misunderstandings. That's all it is. Everybody wants to live a peaceful life. This we often we're in fear of disrespect. I think that's the Islamic world in the Middle East. They feel their culture is completely disrespected. Their concerns are not valued. We have to value each other's concerns, and it's our interest. It's in the interest of the Israeli state to have happy neighbours, as we all know. And it's the interest of the Palestinian state to have happy neighbours. So we have to work together. The thing is, we can work together. It just needs that guts and that leadership. So at least, if you're a Buddhist, don't go around saying that my teacher is better than your teacher. Don't go around saying that my sect is much better than your sect. That Theravada is more original, but Mahayana is more compassionate, but Zen is more direct, and I don't know what the other ones are. Yeah, Mahayana is more funny. But it doesn't matter. Stop sort of comparing and sort of starting to criticize each other. My goodness, this is from the higher realms. Another question, then I get to the higher realms. Sorry, another two questions, then the higher realms, yeah.
My friend's father is recently diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah.
And he has to undergo chemotherapy and to kill off all his cancer cells. So how does a patient that is inflicted with this kind of terminal illness be in harmony with his condition?
Oh.
How is he able to do that?
Okay, that last talk, yeah. The last talk I gave in Perth was on that very question, how to be at peace with your sicknesses. First of all, there's nothing wrong with being sick. Sometimes we look at sickness as something wrong, some mistake, something which is not supposed to be there. And doctors spend their whole lives trying to eradicate all the sicknesses in the world. It's part of the human condition to be sick. So number one, there's nothing wrong with being sick. So when you are sick, don't get embarrassed about it. Because people think sickness is wrong, we don't go and see the doctor in time sometimes. We're afraid of cancer. So sometimes, you know, like women may have lumps in their breast, or men might have trouble urinating or something. And we don't go and see the doctor in time when it could be prostate cancer, it could be breast cancer. Why do we do that? You know, we're afraid because we think sickness is something wrong. Ah, I've got cancer. There's nothing wrong with having cancer. It's just part of life. So number one, just, you know, be in harmony with the nature of this body. It does get old and get sick and die. That's what basic teaching of Buddhism, so obvious. So we're in harmony with this. And when we do get a sickness, there's one of two possibilities. You know that story when I was sick in hospital and Ajahn Chah came to see me and he said, now Brahm, doesn't matter how bad you feel, it's not going to last. You're either going to get better or you're going to die, but it won't last. That's really cutting to the chase. It's getting to the heart of it. So if that person was really smart and they were courageous, you could tell that to them. It doesn't matter, your cancer won't last. It will die. You die first and then the cancer dies next, or the cancer dies first and then you die next. That's the two possibilities. So that's where we're in harmony. And the great thing is that most illnesses, if they're not actually stress-produced, certainly they feed on stress and they get worse because of stress. If you've got harmony with your illness, it's incredible just how very often the illness disappears. Or it certainly doesn't sort of become so intense. So if you... If they're undergoing chemotherapy, they should also do radiation therapy as well. loving kindness, peace radiation therapy. In other words, put peace between themselves and that condition for this time being. Relax, take away the stress, take away the sort of the anger, the ill will towards their condition. The anger and ill will towards their condition will not help at all, but will certainly make things much worse. And then the harmony is, when they're really at peace, just they're giving it the best possible chance to overcome their illness. But if it doesn't go, they're in harmony with that as well. They're at peace with life and death, instead of always sort of trying to control things. It doesn't matter they don't take action. Sure they do, but it's not sort of desperate. You had a question?
My thinking is that the whole basis of education is, as you have rightly said at the beginning, based on competition. And in that, it is a long process. From kindergarten right up to tertiary education. And inbuilt in that competitive way of education, there will be a lot of barricades, mental barricades related to the ego, related to individuality, which is what education, in a Western sense, tries to promote for fulfillment, for attainment, for achievement, and so on. And it's a long time of a person's life. And mental barricades are built, sometimes huge padlocks are built into those gates. Can there be any way that education can be reviewed for this, what you said about Buddha nature, to be made aware?
Yes, you're asking about just strategies for education instead of the barricades or the padlocks, which you say sometimes have dividers against others, sometimes dividers against ourselves. I think when we make like harmony a very important part, we value it a lot. We value cooperation instead of competition. And we value what the one person called emotional intelligence as much as intellectual intelligence. And I think when we change our value systems, then I think education will be more in tune with a system which promotes the values which we want to see appear in our world. I mentioned education because in education we are forming our future members of society, our former future leaders. And because of the intensely competitive nature of modern schools, now whether it's in Malaysia or Japan, because people are just struggling so hard to get to the top jobs or get to universities. You can see what's happening in the corporate world, in marriages, even in religions. We're just looking after our own interests, thinking that that's the whole, not realizing that we're in this together. We have to learn how to work together. And the more that... the more that we are drawn together, you know, visiting each other's countries, living together, befriending each other, I think the more that we have to learn those cooperative skills, the emotional intelligence. I think I'm sure that has to come in our education system. So it's just a matter of like trying to put forth those strategies to encourage it, rather than just going along in the old ways, the old school systems, which promote your particular group at the expense of others. And any company knows they have to cooperate. The word now is synergy, which is actually working together, the energy of coming together. rather than a competition, which kills everybody. Anyway, I'm not sure if I answered your question completely, but I value your question. There's some questions from upstairs now, so I'll answer these if I can. Question one, if there are increasingly more people reaching nirvana, hence no rebirth of the world, would Earth be empty one fine day? If Earth would be empty one fine day, there'd be no one there to know it's empty one fine day. So it doesn't really matter. But just don't be the last. Otherwise you'd be so lonely. Oh, everyone else is enlightened. I'm the last one on earth. Oh. But if you really were the last one, you'd be enlightened very quickly. You've got no one to get angry at. How to guide the kids whose parents are of different faiths. Oh, that's great. If you've got kids whose parents are of different faiths, say for example, they are Christian and Buddhist, then every time there's a Buddhist talk, you should take your kids to hear the Buddhist talk. Every time there's a Christian service, you should take your kids to the Christian service. So they're exposed to both. So, like, life growing up is an education. So expose them. Take them also to the mosque, if it's possible. Take them to the Hindu temple. And so after a while, let them choose. This is actually what we do in schools when you're looking for your career in life. You go to different lectures, maybe on geography, history, science, or whatever. And the one which you like, you go for. Not everybody will be a Buddhist, not everybody will be a Christian. And it's wonderful they're not. You've all, they know my little book, there's a simile of the old man and the violin. And I won't tell that story because we're running out of time. Look it up in the book about how different instruments are important to create an orchestra. And different faiths are important to create our world. So we respect every member of the orchestra of all the different types of instruments. We respect every member of all faith traditions and no faith traditions. Everyone is valued. All members of the great orchestra we call our world. It's wonderful if instead of trying to compete against each other like an orchestra, you can all play in harmony together. You know, it's really amazing when we do that, when the Buddhists and the Muslims get together and we really sort of get it on and start talking. We did like an interfaith dialogue in Singapore last December the 30th or 31st or whatever it was. It was a great dialogue. You know, when I was on the stage with a Muslim from Singapore, from the, what's it, the Muslim Converts Association, we had a great dialogue there. And we trusted each other enough to actually really get deep into the heart of our religions. We've done the same with other Christians and with Hindus. It's marvelous when you see people who really know their religion and know the message in those books and have actually internalized it, can actually express it in a ways which the other person can understand. Mostly it's a language problem. And getting beyond, you know, the language of our cultures to express it in a way which the other person can understand. And then so often the Muslims say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. Was it somebody, I forget the quote now, but it was, But it's a very wonderful quote by an Islamic scholar about Buddhism. So that's actually how to guide kids whose parents are different faiths, to respect the lot and value the lot. How you develop harmony with the family when you have a different religion? There we go. When one other religion's got into desperate in converting others into their belief. You don't want to convert other people, because that's not loving them, that's hating them for who they are. So to convert another person is, you know, try to give them an extreme makeover. As you all know, extreme makeovers, whether it's religious extreme makeovers or extreme makeovers of your body, which, you know what extreme makeovers are, don't you? You know, when you go to these nip and tuck merchants who sort of make you look very different than you looked before. Whether it's that's hating yourself. Hating who you are and hating sort of, you know, who your partner is. So trying to convert someone is actually hating. So the person who tries to convert others doesn't know love at all. Doesn't know how to create peace and value the differences in people. Nevertheless, I don't know if I told that story, that on the first year of our monastery in Australia, when we moved into this block of land, 100 acres, we didn't have much money, but we had a few building tools, and we were afraid, because it only had a simple wire fence around it, that burglars would come in and steal. So the abbot asked me to put a sign on the wire fence. He asked me to put the usual sign, "Trespassers will be prosecuted." I say, that wouldn't work. I had a new sign which read, "Trespassers will be converted." No one came in. That's lateral thinking. The trouble was that after a few weeks my sign was stolen. I thought it was funny. I said, well, thank you. Someone declares himself, herself to be your enemy without valid reason except misperception. You know you should confront, talk with the person, but you couldn't bring yourself to do it. What would Ajahn Brahm suggest? If they call yourself their enemy, they must have hit their head that morning. They're crazy. So sometimes you can't do anything about that except not feed their hatred. So don't feed their hatred by getting angry back at them. If they're your enemy, they're trying to abuse you, just don't allow yourself to have your happiness controlled by other people's stupidity. We live in a divided world where certain religious teachers teach their followers what is ours belongs to us, what is theirs belongs to us too. Your concept of us only works if both parties think alike. How do you live in a world with your concept of us amongst people who don't think like that? What would it leave you with? It's, if people don't think that like that now, they have to, because it's the truth. You know, it is us. We've got like the water which we drink. We've got the air which we breathe. This is our major resources in the world. And we have to share them. We do share the air. No one can actually just put like a big, you know, bell jar around Malaysia and say, this is our air, no one else will allow to breathe it. The same with our rivers, with our water, with all the other resources. That's, you know, why you have, you know, things like Kyoto protocols. Because it's a recognition that we're in this planet together. And if somebody just messes up the atmosphere in one country, it's going to go all the way around the world, as you know with the Indonesian forest fires, just the smog it causes in Malaysia. So it's not ours, it's not mine anymore. It's all ours. And that's something which, you know, that once we get that into our minds, maybe that we can encourage our politicians and our leaders to also think the same. It's great that our politicians go and study in other countries. Because actually when you study in other countries or grow up in other countries, sometimes you get a wider vision of about the big world and see what it's all about, instead of just being so nationalistic. I think the point is now that there's no other way. It's getting desperate. And I think that usually what happens in our world, I've noticed this like in wars. I know my parents always used to say that the most harmonious time, you know, in England was actually during the Second World War. They had to work together in harmony and peace. There was no arguments then because it was all for one. It was desperate. They had to do that. And they said that was the most harmonious and peaceful time. And we can do that again. We're not at war with like each other. We're at war with the dangers of the climate, with the dangers of economy, with the dangers of things like AIDS, with drugs. So we're at war with poverty. So when we look at those sorts of wars, we're in it together. So I think it's just how you make both parties think alike is actually by... I think one of the biggest things is we don't think deeply enough. And we stop at the books. We stop at what we're told by other people instead of thinking things out for ourselves. So I think religious teachers, school teachers, parents should actually encourage our children to think, to question. Because in thinking and questioning, we're endowing each one of us to actually to find the truth. Not just to believe blindly. How to help my friend who believes in occult religions deviate as he thinks that his health problem can only be cured by them? Okay, if he wants to join a cult for a while, that's okay. Cults don't last all that long. It's only sort of a passing thing. Anicca, can only be cured by them. It's, you know what happens usually, that this is well known in sociology. When people join a cult, actually, first of all, it's an interesting thing I should mention, that France has passed a law a couple of years ago against cults. What is actually said, that if there's any faith, religion or cult which is harmful of fundamental human rights and basic human freedoms, then it can be legislated against. Because this is actually an interesting way of seeing religious freedom is important, but with every freedom there has to be responsibilities, and sometimes those responsibilities need to be legislated against as well. So, religious freedom is one thing, but it has to have some people abuse the freedom. So in the same way there's freedom of the press, but there's responsibilities of the press, and the way we actually find that balance is very, very important. And so, some cults, if there was a Buddhist cult, I don't care what type of cult it is, but if it doesn't allow questioning, if it doesn't allow people to come and go, then sometimes that's very dangerous. And there's been many of those cults where there's like Heaven's Gate, where people committed suicide in great numbers, or for those old enough to know the Jonestown in Guyana, where there's sort of a crazy, I think James Jones or whatever, Jim Jones, that's right, a crazy guy. About 800, 900 people died there, wasn't it, or something? They all committed suicide. So those cults can be very dangerous, criminal even, and they should be looked at. Ajahn, do you regard the conversion of Buddhists to Christianity in Sri Lanka to be a problem? If so, what do we do? And recently, the Buddhists in Australia were allowed to have an exhibition at the Sydney Parliament House. Tell us how you managed to do this. Okay, first of all, if a person has been a Buddhist for a long time, they don't usually convert to Christianity deeply. It's only a superficial one. I learned this some years ago when I was in Thailand visiting our monastery over there, and the abbot there said, look, I've been invited to teach a meditation workshop for one day at a Catholic ceremony in just outside of Pattaya. He said, look, I'm really busy. Can you do it, Ajahn Brahm? I said, sure, I don't mind doing it. So I taught this meditation seminar to the Catholics. I taught it in Thai. And all these Thai people, when they came for their interviews, they wanted to make a donation. I said, what are you making a donation for? You're a Christian. I'm a Buddhist. And just, I don't know how many of them said this. They said, shh, don't tell the pastor, but I'm really a Buddhist. They say, I'm only telling him I'm a Christian because my son goes to school and he doesn't go to university in the West and he gets free medical care. They said this, and it's actually fascinating. They said, I'm only sort of converting for business reasons. That's what they said. So I know this is a problem with many of you, that sometimes you may have a Christian friend or a Christian in your family and they come to your bedside when you're about to die. And they won't leave you alone until you convert to being a Christian. And my advice to you is convert to being a Christian. And as soon as they're out of the room and they're happy, convert back again. You can convert one way, you can convert the other way, can't you? Just a good way of getting rid of them. Being practical again. Okay, and the Buddhists in Australia allowed to have an exhibition in Sydney. I think it's because the Buddhists over in Australia, they've shown themselves to be peaceful. They've shown themselves to be people who don't cause problems to governments. And who are always very supportive. Who always have a very high moral standard. And who speak a lot of sense. One thing was with politicians in democratic countries, that they are faced with practical decisions, not theoretical, theological decisions, because they have to move forward. They're not, you know, they're not living in ivory towers as politicians. They've got people, they've got economies, they've got things to get done in their country. And I think the Buddhists are very practical as well. And I think that the two of them go together. I think many times the Buddhists and the politicians get on very, very well. I think I mentioned this in my state, Western Australia. The senior politicians in the state government are very, very positive towards Buddhism. So much so that in their cabinet meetings, the Premier of Western Australia, his name is Dr. Jeff Gallop, every time there's an argument starts, he bangs the table and says, "Stop, shut up, we should be more Buddhist about this." That's what he says all the time, apparently. Because, and the reason he says that, he has the idea, and many people have this idea in the West. They may not understand Buddhism in detail, but they know that Buddhism is a peaceful, calm, tolerant religion. And the reason they know that is because for 2,500 years it's shown that, it's proved that. We haven't had wars. We haven't sort of reacted with violence when violence has been done to Buddhists. And that's very praiseworthy. So I think many politicians know that, you know, Buddhism is actually a force for good in their societies. So because of that, I think the politicians in Australia, they realise there's no danger in having a Buddhist exhibition in the parliament houses of their states. I think they value it, and it's going to get stronger and stronger. There's, you know, Buddhist principles. It's just so common sense. They're so sharp. They're so positive. They don't, you know, they don't demand their own rights. They just want to serve others or serve us. Dear Ajahn, how do you create harmony within oneself? Thank you. The way you create harmony within yourself is letting go, being at peace with things. By meditating. All of those of you who meditate, if you meditate trying to get somewhere, that's being disharmony with this moment. You don't meditate to get somewhere, you meditate to be more fully where you are. You meditate without a destination. If you're trying to get someplace, you're not in harmony with where you are now. So let go, be at peace. And this is actually why meditation, if you understand what meditation is, it's such an easy thing to do. Whatever you're experiencing, you allow it to be. Don't do anything. If you're sick and you're meditating, you're at peace with your sickness. If your mind is restless, you're at peace with restlessness. If your mind is nodding off, you're at peace with nodding off. Stop fighting. That's making war, it's not making harmony. Comment. I am a Sikh and I enjoy so much coming to BGF. Sadhu, sadhu. I didn't write this, but it just proves what I've just been saying. It is so true that when we don't know much about others who are different, we tend to be afraid of them. Personally, I find so many commonalities between Buddhism and Sikhism. Yeah. You know, I must admit that I really love Sikhs. I've always loved Sikhs. No, that's, I don't know. Maybe I was one of those some time ago. Because, I don't know, they've always been so friendly and so nice. And they've always got a good sense of humour. Because we were doing this interfaith service once in the Christian cathedral in Perth. And I was sitting next to this Sikh guy. And every now and again, you know, somebody would give a speech. And then we'd go up and stand up for an affirmation. And then the dean would tell us to sit down again. And then we'd listen to some other boring speech. Then we'd have to stand up again to another affirmation. I'd turn around. Look, the reason why I have to keep standing up is to make sure that no one falls asleep. And he laughed his head off as well. So I found Sikhs have a great sense of humour. And of course, they're very spiritual people. So great. I love the Sikhs. And they're actually very gentle as well, even though they carry these knives around. They never use them. I think it's, you know, to cut their apples. I don't know, I shouldn't say things like that. Do we direct our lives or do we direct others' lives? Okay. We direct the space between us and them. So we don't direct my life. We don't direct your life. We direct the space between us and them. Get that? That's important. Is marriage just a certificate? Can we cohabitate without the legal part of it? Thank you. Okay. When you have the certificate, it means you make a public commitment. And the public commitment is important. Because whatever you do in public, this is why we do ceremonies, where you take the five precepts in front of a monk. Because if you take it in front of a monk, in front of a Buddha statue, it means more. Just psychologically, because you're doing it in public, in a ceremony, it just gets into the mind in a more powerful way. So it's the same way if you go through a commitment ceremony of marriage, it means more. It's much more powerful than if you just live together. This is why when I do my marriages, I call that when you just live together or just go out, that's called involvement. Marriage is commitment. And the difference between involvement and commitment is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, the chicken is only involved, but the pig is committed. Think about it. And it's true, you know, the chicken only gives an egg, that's all. That's why if you have a marriage, you keep your whole life. Say, right, this is it. I've chosen that guy. I've chosen that girl. This is it. And I'm going to say that in front of all my relations and friends. That I commit myself to you. Life. I'm going to give the whole lot. It was us last Sunday in Singapore, this, and I said that. They said, how long should you keep on trying if the marriage isn't working? When should you give up? I said, when you're dead. What if one cannot find a life partner? How long do we keep on looking? Gave that answer already. So you're dead. And the other answer is you have a life partner already. You. How do we create harmony if the other party refuses to make peace with you? Even if we manage to see the Buddha in him and forgive him, but he refuses to be on good terms with you. Why do people refuse to be on good terms with you? It doesn't actually usually work that way. It's a strange thing. If you can see the Buddha nature in someone else, if you respect somebody else, they respect you back. It's like, you know, karma and this result, karma vipaka. I've seen that so many times. You have an enemy. You find something you can love and respect in them, and you focus on that. They will love you back. Which is one of the reasons why marriages, you know, do get in problem, because you don't respect your partner. You don't show respect to them. Of course, they won't show respect to you. But if you see something in them, put aside all the faults. Remember why you fell in love with them the first time. Why you married them. Remember that. Focus on that. And if you start thinking about that when you meet your partner, then your partner will be reminded why they fell in love with you. You try that. It's incredible just how powerful that is. What you see in others, they see in themselves. If you're focusing on something pure and good, they start to focus on what's pure and good in you. But if you give them anger and cutting speech and always bickering and being down, then they're gonna, that's what they give back to you. It's common sense. So you, but the trouble is we get into these habits. They give this stuff to me, they have to give it back to them, you know, twice over. And it just intensifies every time you speak. It gets worse and worse and worse until you have this terrible bickering between, you know, grown-up adults. That's, what is it they say, that the first year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. The second year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. The third year of marriage, the neighbours listen to both of them. As they shout and scream at each other. Dear Ajahn, my sister has been having bad dreams, i.e. a black dog biting her, same dog many times, and don't want to let go. When she's driving, there is a knock on her windows. Any indication? Thank you. Okay. I like dogs. So the next time that sort of she has a dream, next time she goes to bed, maybe just, what do dogs like? Maybe take her like a bone or something and put it under the pillow. No, try that. I'm serious. Because what it does, it just reminds you, this, it's a gift there, it's kindness, compassion towards the dog. And in the dream, sort of because, you know, you've done that before you've gone to bed, you've actually got compassion for that little animal. And so when it comes up in your dream, that last mind state when you went to sleep will come up, and this black dog will come to bite you again. Instead you give this bone, and your enemy will become your friend. It's like compassion and kindness. If you have bad dreams, sometimes it's because what you go to bed with. You know, just the last thoughts, you know, what was in your mind when you went to sleep. So put some compassion, loving kindness in there. And you can say, all those little enemies, which are those bad dreams you have, you can turn them into beautiful dreams. And so often you can, I've been doing this for years, I actually don't get bad dreams these days. Whenever you get like a monster, you turn it into a friend. You get compassion. Monsters, nobody likes monsters. So if I see a monster come up in my dream, oh, you poor thing, you must be so lonely, you look so ugly, no one else likes you. But I like you, monster. You know, there's this old story in Western folklore, I think you probably know it as well, about the princess who was turned into a frog. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful princess, and this wicked witch put a spell on her, and she turned into a very ugly toad. And the spell would only be broken when a prince or a young man would give this toad a kiss, and then she would turn back into a beautiful princess. And one day this young man saw that frog, kissed it, and it turned into a beautiful princess, and they both lived happily ever after. You've heard that story before, haven't you? What does it mean? I'll tell you what it means. The meaning behind that story is that sometimes that people in life are turned into ugly frogs. They were once beautiful princesses, but because of the wicked witch called Mara, the tempter, they were turned into ugly people, but underneath there somewhere is the beautiful Buddha nature, the beautiful princess. And one day, somebody comes along and gives them the kiss of compassion. Even though they may be an enemy, somebody really terrible and ugly and offensive, you have the guts to be kind to them. And it just gives them the kindness, and they turn into this beautiful princess. That frog might be your husband. He was once this wonderful young man you fell in love with, but now, because of delusion, he's turned into this ugly old toad. And all you need to do is give him some compassion, a kiss, and the spell of the Mara will be broken. He'll turn into this beautiful young man you once fell in love with again. So the wicked witch is like, in Buddhism, Mara, the Buddhist idea of like a devil, delusion, which turns your beauty into something ugly. And the only way to break that spell is compassion, kindness, love. So that black dog is really a beautiful princess underneath. So when that black dog, I don't know if this is my sister, okay, beautiful prince. So it's this amazing hunk of a prince. So tell your sister to give that black dog a nice big kiss. And he'll turn into this amazing hunk of a boy. In your dreams. Like, when she's driving, there's a knock on her window. Is there any indication? I don't know. That's another one. Leave that one, because that could be anything. How do we create harmony if the other... Actually, they should mention that... that's right. Somebody said to me in Singapore recently that sometimes at night time, they hear this sound like someone's walking on their roof, or that somebody's throwing stones on their roof. It's ghosts making all these knocking sounds at night. I said, look, I know about roofs because I've put many roofs on in my life as a building monk. At night time, I said, you know, the weather cools down, the wood, the timber, the metal starts to contract. And those are just like building, sort of contracting sounds. It's not people walking on your roof. And somebody put their hand up and said, yes, and they saw a program about that. There was a house somewhere in the United States which somebody thought was haunted, and they got the scientists out there, and the scientists thought all it was, these sounds were just the natural sounds of a house moving, which it does. It expands during the day because it heats up. It contracts at night time. That's all it is. So that's probably just all it is, the knocking on the door is just of the car. It's probably something natural, just the movement of the parts of the car. No more than that. Natural. Okay, I've got that one down. Can we keep going for a bit? It's 10 o'clock. Got three questions left? Okay. How should Buddhists react to those religious groups who call themselves the real Buddhists? In fact, the teaching is deviate from the Dharma. Concentrate on self-centered, on their leaders. Lots of young people have seen something lead by the group and thinking that they are Buddhists. Okay. I think it's how do we know what's real Buddhism and what's not real Buddhism? The Buddha gave this beautiful teaching once. He said, whatever leads to peace, to harmony, to freedom, you can know that's the teachings of the Buddha. If it doesn't lead to those things, it can't be the teachings of the Buddha. Unfortunately, that people have got this feeling for what the Buddha taught. It's compassion, kindness, peace, tolerance, freedom. And if it's not that, you can see it's nothing to do with Buddhism. In fact, really, you could apply those things to all religions, all truth. Truth has to be something which creates harmony in the world. Otherwise, it's not truth. It doesn't feel like truth. Don't care what it says in the books. It has to be something which leads to peace, to freedom, to happiness. Otherwise, it can't be truth. So you know it by what it does. By their acts, ye shall know them. That's Christian Bible. So this is actually how we can know what real Buddhism is. So if it's a Buddhism which is a cult, which doesn't allow anybody else, and just said, do what I say, and don't listen to anybody else, only come to my teacher, don't go to other teachers, there's something terribly wrong there. What I say is that, look, you don't keep on coming to Ajahn Brahm's teachings, go to other monks, other nuns' teachings, go to other religions' teachings. No one owns the truth. Everybody, whoever they are, will have their take on the truth, their expression of the truth. And the whole thing is the truth is like out there, like the air. No one can bottle it and sell it. We've got bottled water these days. It's crazy having bottled water. I just read a newspaper that I think it was Coca-Cola were caught out in England. They were actually just getting water out of the tap in Reading and selling it as bottled water with a markup price of about 10 times until they were caught out. It's just what you can actually get out of the tap from the local water authority. And, I might get into trouble here, but you know Evian water? What does it spell backwards? Naive. spell it backwards. E-V-I-A-N, backwards, N-A-I-V-E, naive. Okay. Is creating harmony, aren't we creating more attachments instead of letting go? Harmony is created from letting go. Sometimes we don't understand the difference between attachments and letting go. This is an old simile of a bird on a tree. Someone pointed this out to me about 10 years ago. They said when birds roost on a tree at night, they go to sleep. Even in a wind, when the tree is swaying, those birds never fall off. I've never seen in my life a bird fall off a tree at night when they're asleep. So how can they relax and have a good night's sleep when they're way up there? If you were just on a branch of a tree, could you relax and go to sleep? Especially on a windy night? So the answer is that the claws of a bird, the more they relax, the more they close up. If they really relax, they close up more. That's their nature. The more they let go, the more they stay still, the more they cling on. So sometimes it's the same with harmony. The more we let go, the more stable we are, the more harmony we have. So it's not attachments, it's the opposite. In the morning when the bird wakes up, he has to put effort to actually open its claws. When it's relaxed, it's so stable. The more relaxed it is, the more stable it is, the more safe it is. So creating harmony is not attachment, it's actually letting go. Dear Ajahn, does it mean bad karma when a person does not get married? If that was true, then I must be making lots of bad karma. I think that answers the question. Thank you for listening today, and thank you for all those questions. Okay.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for that wonderful talk. And judging from the response and the questions, a lot of you have been I'm sure a lot of you enjoyed that talk. And we would like to invite the President, Dr. Victor Wee, to give a token of appreciation to Ajahn Brahm.
Very good. Very good. You can put it down there because it goes to my monastery, not to me. Very good. Take it. I don't think there's any money in there. It's probably an invitation to come back again. I hope. Okay, shall we do a sharing of merits? Okay, we'll do a sharing of merits now for all sentient beings. So the understanding that what affects us affects others, what affects others affects us. So that way we're looking at the us when we're sharing merits between all sentient beings. Please repeat with me. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyati nang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.